Ladies and gentlemen, it's Thursday, which means it's Normal World Thursday. I don't even know what that means.
It's a thing now.
Yeah, it's a thing now. I'm Dave Lando.
I'm Corda Black. Garrett. And there's Angela.
I'm Angela. Hi.
There's Angela.
Hashtag Normal Thursday.
Yeah. We have to be serious today.
We do.
We have a good guest.
We do have a good guest. Which means why don't you like and subscribe? Please subscribe, because 40% of you that watch don't.
Come on.
Just hit the button.
Don't you want to get notified? You're here watching the show.
How hard is it to do that?
We would love it if you did that. Please do that.
Please do that for us.
So sorry for what I said yesterday.
No. Yeah, it really, she really is sorry. She wrote a letter to several of the people that were handicapped. Okay. Now, this weekend, I'm going to be into the Tacoma Comedy Club. That's where I'm going to be.
Oh.
But more importantly, I'm going to be joining our next guest, legendary film director, director of Rain Over Me, director of Blank Man, writer and director of the show Mind of a Married Man on HBO. Tons of stuff. I don't need to bring it up, but it will be the Night of Laughter this Sunday with RFK Jr. and friends, April 21st at the Royal Oak Music Theater. Please welcome to the show somebody
not
who...
April 21st, right there.
Okay. Oh, that's correct.
Okay.
That's the
second
wrong poster.
Keep them a different one.
It's the wrong poster, but it's on there.
It's okay. At least there's a poster. Anyway, please welcome Mike Binder.
Oh, it's so good to be here, man.
Thank you for coming in.
I spent the whole afternoon liking and subscribing.
Oh, thank God.
It took everything I had, but I did it.
I appreciate it. You kept unliking and liking it.
No, I just, like.
Yeah.
Subscribe.
Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me. Seriously, Dave, I'm a big, big fan of yours. I love your stand-up.
Dude, likewise. It really means a lot to me. And I'm really looking forward to Sunday night. We're going to be in Royal Oak.
Royal Oak at the Royal Oak Theater, which is like...
It's going to be awesome.
It's like going back to my youth. I used to play that theater with Dave Coulier and Howie Mandel and Paul Rodriguez. We would do Detroit comedy jams there. And,
yeah.
And God, I did that theater a lot when I was a kid.
And you started in Detroit.
In Detroit, yeah.
Is that where you did your first open mic, everything?
Yes. Are you kidding? Yeah. Everything. In Ann Arbor at the Blind Pig.
Oh, that's right. That's still there.
Yeah.
If you ever want to be stuffed in there and watch Hank 3 do a set and then get violently ill, highly recommend that venue.
Yeah,
okay.
That would make me want to like and subscribe.
Yes.
What got you into directing movies? You were a comedian, and then what?
I was a comedian, but I grew up just like as a little Jewish kid, just enamored with Woody Allen and Mel Brooks.
Of course, yes.
And, so the next thing, it was a different era. There were very few people that just stayed a comedian and got great at it. You became a comedian so you could have a sitcom or make movies and so.
Yeah, the idea was you got on Carson.
Yeah.
And then you ended up on something, and then you became huge. It was like Roseanne had 5 minutes, but then had a lifetime of movies.
Right.
And
not
that she wasn't great. I just mean but that's what you wanted, was that character scene, so you could then have a career.
It was the path.
Yeah, yeah. But even more, like for me, I just thought, okay, well, I want to be a comedian because I want to make my own movies.
Mm-hmm.
That was my dream in life, was to make my own movies. Because I think if the world existed the way it did now, I'd say, hey, I just want to have my own show.
Right.
It would be different, right? I like the fact that so many comedians now just want to be great comedians. They want to stay with it their whole lives.
Yeah.
It's great because it's something that can never be perfected. Like, no matter how many times you do it, you just keep trying. You keep trying to get better. Nobody can.
It's so weird.
You can only argue who's the best. You can only. It's something that you can constantly evolve at.
And for me, I was out of it for 28 years. I was, in the game because I was a director and an actor, and I directed guys' specials and stuff. But I didn't go on stage for a long time. And when I stopped, Jay Leno was like kind of like my older brother in comedy. I used to hang with him. and I was getting movies made and doing all these things, and I had a show on HBO, and don't quit your act. Don't quit your binder. Why are you not doing your act? Never let go of your act. And I thought, what a stupid thing to say, you know? Why would you not let go of your move? Why would you not move on?
Yeah,
right.
And I realized he was 100% right. And he was one of the very, you know, very few guys from my era that just stayed with their act, him and Seinfeld, and really that's it, you know?
When he would go up, when I first moved to LA myself, he was up at Comedy Magic Club still, like every Sunday night.
He still is.
Yeah, they never ever stopped. And like, so you went from Detroit, you went to LA, you started at the Comedy Store like right after, like or like days before Freddie Prinze.
Yeah.
I guess offed himself, there's no
other. Yeah, I was there. And I didn't really know anybody yet. I just knew them, you know, one son.
What year about was that?
It was in the 40s.
Oh. Yes, it was mid-40s. It was back,
what, 80?
77.
Yes, it was just before it became the Comedy Store. It was still called Rizzo's or whatever.
Rizzo's, no, Zero's.
Zero's. Okay.
It was called Honkies, you know? They just gave it a name.
We go table to table. I was a waiter that did magic.
I was there, and, you know, it was this magical place to me, and...
And by that, you were doing coke.
Yeah, that's exactly. You read my book.
80s were coming up.
And I was very lucky. I was really lucky because place was about to explode, and I went there, and on a Monday night, first Monday night, and I went on amateur night, and I killed. And I had never killed before.
Yeah.
You know, I had done okay in Detroit, you know, but I just didn't have that much experience. That was later when I came back and did Bees and The Castle and all that.
Bees Comedy Kitchen.
But I just killed this Monday night. It just, the stars lined up, and Mitzi was like, oh, you can work out here. You need to be here. You're good. And she gave me a job, and which I needed a job. And I babysitted her, Peter and Paulie, during the day, and so I had enough money to get an apartment. You know, it was great.
Were you a door guy?
Yeah, I was a door guy.
Oh, yeah. That's awesome. And you were a door guy at the time of where I guess you have what, Robin Williams? You have at that time
Letterman and Leno, and
I was gonna say both of them coming in, and then Pryor.
Pryor was in all the time. Wow. Yeah.
Who was the most electric person you saw on stage at that time? Honestly, like the one that
Pryor
was it Pryor?
Pryor was he was it was magical.
Was he somebody?
Robin too.
I would imagine that had to be amazing. But was Pryor doing something? Because I always loved him and respected him. My dad did, and so I did as a kid. But I can only imagine at that time, because it was something so actually dangerous, and a lot of the stuff he was saying can get your ass kicked. Like, was he really doing something that made the crowd uncomfortable, or was he killing every single night?
No, he didn't kill every single night at all. That's what
made him great.
What was great about Richard, and he was the first guy that I ever saw, or my group of comics ever saw, that he would do this incredible hour, lock it in, film it, and then come up to the store every night for months and start completely over and just talk to the audience, and they'd go crazy, and then he'd have nothing to say and bomb, you know?
Right.
And try all these things out. And it wasn't that, you know, it wasn't that he was being, you know, just outlandish to be outlandish. It was just some of the stuff wasn't that funny yet, you know?
Yeah.
He was experimenting.
Really trying to
work. He was trying things. Yeah. And he would stay with him and rewrite. And he was very much loved the craft, you know? He very much loved the craft.
Because he was so Cosby-esque for a long time, and I, of course, only mean that in the way of comedy and being clean. Not that, you know, he didn't rape everyone. Yeah. But yeah, it's...
He did both. Oh. He worked both lanes.
Oh, that's good. Oh,
yeah, he was like Cosby.
Okay. Yeah, good. Felt perfectly. They were awake.
different MO.
Is that better or worse? Yeah, yeah. I honestly don't know.
Look, I think if he gives you a chance to fight, it makes you a better man.
At least they're involved.
Just how I feel about it. But
Richard was a guy for a while, man, you know, I have to tell you, he'd come to the Comedy Store and it was packed. And, you know, as the doormen, we were getting rich for us, you know, selling out getting tips to give front row seats and it's just like, because he'd be there and he'd just drop in and he'd work out for months at a time and people had to see him live,
right?
You know, they had to see him, and it was just amazing. It was just, and the women threw themselves at him.
Oh, I'm sure it had to be impossible for him to avoid that. Just the addict in him and the stuff that he talked about.
Oh, it was amazing. It was amazing. But he was, to the comedians, to us, he was just such a good guy. He was just very real.
Yeah, he was somebody who I tell a lot of stories on stage too in my act, and he was just somebody who I loved, was so open in a way that I don't think I've ever seen anybody before or since really to be that open and direct, but really taking a risk at talking about what a terrible person they could be and making it great, like shooting out the tires on his wife's car. I mean, like,
he kind of invented that.
Yeah.
You know, him and Lily Tomlin.
She's great too.
And, you know,
Detroit.
Yeah. They really invented it. You know, it's really funny because when I got back into stand-up, I went to lunch with a couple guys from my era and they were going, we're not doing it anymore. I don't know why you would do it. He goes, one of them says, they don't even want bits anymore. All they want is stories and autobiographical comedy. Well, that's great.
Yeah.
You know?
It's a good thing.
He goes, I want to do bits. You know? Well, you can do those at home to the dogs.
I think people just want to connect with you on a real level.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, some people do very well. I mean, you have comics like Jimmy Carr, Anthony Jeselnik that are great. Yeah. They're very much a bit.
Yeah, they still do that.
David Tell's very bit driven, and he's one of the best to ever live. So, it's there's still that element of it. I think, though, when you can talk about something so openly, though, it is, I don't know, there's a connection that's special with an audience now that just didn't exist before.
Well, you know what I like? You know, one of the reasons why I quit, I realized, years later when I came back, when I did that Comedy Store documentary,
yes,
which I spent 2.5 years making.
You directed that and produced it, didn't you?
Yeah. And
what's the name of it for the audience?
It's called The Comedy Store, Dave.
I knew that.
Okay.
Comedy Store.
I meant that.
Yeah.
Check out The Comedy Store.
It's called The Comedy Store Documentary.
Yeah.
It's
actually. Yeah, I forgot.
I like how you kept it simple.
I forgot the fourth word.
Yeah. But that was an incoming call. That Peter Shore and Mike Tolan called me. But I realized, man, when I was a kid, I did not respect the art form the way the people I respected did. Mm. And then when I got back in and I'm interviewing all these guys, I realized, God, all these people that are so great, they work so hard and they rewrite. And having been in the movies all those years and television and stuff, you have to respect the process. You know, you have to stay with it. You can't, but as a comedian, as a young kid, and plus being all messed up on drugs and everything and right. partying, I never worked on my act. So what do you folks want to talk about? You know,
right.
Yeah.
You know, it just was like, I'd just get up there just to get up there so I could get off stage and get high again.
Right.
You know?
Well, and if your goal is to be more, you know, in film and direct movies and stuff, it's probably not it's not your number one thing that you're trying to do is figure out how to be the greatest at this if you want to be the greatest at that at the time.
Yeah. But by the same token, I think, if you're doing something, there's no point in not doing it 100%.
Oh, I agree. And I'll tell you a company that does do 100%. It's Miracle Made Sheets, my friend.
Oh,
man. I'm going to tell you right now.
Holy sheet, do I love Miracle Made.
Should. Your temperature at night might have one of the greatest impacts on your sleep quality, and I'll tell you that.
That's right.
I get hot.
Hot.
If you wake up too hot or too cold, like you probably do, I highly recommend you check out Miracle Made Bed Sheets. They're inspired by NASA. They're luxurious.
Oh.
They're comfortable.
Oh.
You know what? They're affordable.
Oh, man. I was afraid you were going to say all those things, and it was going to be like $1 million for one of these sheets, because, I mean,
I can have all that and save money? Impossible. No, it's possible. Go to trymiracle.com/normal. Use code normal, and you will get not one, not two, but three free towels.
That's right.
And save 20%. That's 20.
20.
20%. Go to trymiracle.com, normal, and see that?
Look at that.
Look how comfy she is.
Super snug.
Yeah, she's like, oh, this feels so good. This feels so good, and I'm not even hot anymore.
Cover me in the miracle,
I was
man.
So hot a minute ago, and now I'm all cold.
Oh, yeah. We didn't even...
You know why she looks so good, Dave?
Yes.
She just subscribed to your show.
That's right.
That's right. Oh, she's definitely subscribing and hitting like.
She liked and subscribed.
She liked and subscribed, and she's got that glow about her.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know what else I heard? That she shared an episode with a friend.
That's what happened.
Yep.
That's why she's so happy.
It's true. That's why she's smiling. She's like, I was enjoying this, and you know why? It was your episode, Mike.
Yep.
This one right here.
That's what it is. That's what it is.
It's true. So go to trymiracle.com/normal and share this episode.
Do it.
And get the discount. So I have to ask you about, I've been a big fan for a long time. When I started Mark Lee's Comedy Castle, you were like the first person he mentioned to me. You, Bob Saget, were like his favorite comics. He loved Coulier because he had started there. But the first two names he had heard who were always, he just said killers in the comedy club were you and Saget. And Saget, I know you knew. And he said Saget was the only person he ever saw get an encore. Said it had never happened ever. And he was like, they're just clapping. Just go out and say another joke.
Do it again.
And I think it's great.
I actually saw Coulier get a lot of encores.
Did he get some?
He got standing ovations. Coulier.
Well, I don't doubt it.
Yeah. But Saget would confuse just people still clapping. Oh, they want an encore. No, Bob, I think they're just clapping.
But, yeah. Like, are you sure? I could go right back out.
But yeah, no, Saget was great, and those were great times, man. There was a great Tim Allen's early days, and there was a guy named Ollie Joe Prater that we worked with.
I remember that name.
You know, he was a nut. And Mark started that whole. Mark came out to L.A., and I met him at the Comedy Store, and we were all doing a show called Make Me Laugh. Okay. And it was a strip show. We would shoot 5 episodes a day at KTLA. A guy named Bobby Van hosted it. And it would be 3 comedians, like a typical, and we would shoot the whole week. We'd shoot all 5 in one day, and it would air 11 o'clock Monday through Friday all across the country, syndicated.
Yeah.
And like a typical, it'd be me, Shandling, and Gary Muledeer.
Oh, wow.
You know, or Bruce amazing. Baum, Saget, and Tim Thomerson.
Yeah.
You know, and it was 3 guys, and you'd play contestants. They'd try to make them laugh, and they'd try not to laugh. And then a celebrity would come out and play for charity. And Mark said, you know, look, I want to do a comedy club. I'm trying to do a comedy club with local comics, but I'm thinking I'll bring a headliner and do 3 guys, you know? But no one was doing that. There was the Improvs in the Comedy Store in L.A. and the Improv in New York and the Holy City Zoo in San Francisco.
This is like 20 comics a night. All
yeah,
showcase.
20, yeah. Exactly. And then so Mark started, and I was his first headliner, you know? And what we would do, and then it went to, the next one was the Cleveland Comedy Club. And the Columbus Comedy Club, then the Atlanta had the Punchline, and then their chain started, and then there was the Comedy Crockpot. I mean, it was just like...
And then the names got worse from there.
It was
the 80s.
It was horrible. Yeah, yeah. It was you know, the Comedy Canker Sore, and you know, it got really bad for
comedy
a while.
Comedy Crab Apples.
But the thing was, for a while, we... That make me laugh, guys, because you'd go on 5 nights a week. So if you'd hit a town either the week that your show ran or two weeks after, you know, you could pack these clubs.
Mm. That's insane.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was an incredible, and I was 19 years old.
Which is right out of Detroit.
Yeah.
Which is incredible, and that's at a time, too, where, Yeah, you've reinvented sort of what stand-up is, and for everybody here who's probably been to a club now, that means what he's saying is when you go in and you see the feature act, who's the middle, you know, the host, and then the headliner, that did not exist. It was all just showcases. It was all just 10, 20 people on stage. And then
that's so many.
This is essentially what started the whole, hey, this is a 90-minute show or whatever it was, and this is exactly how it should be stacked.
Or even more, for me, Dave, like growing up in Detroit, there were no places to see comedy unless I went to Pine Knob and saw a comedian open, or Masonic Temple, or you know what I'm saying? Big name act. There were a few places like music acts, and every now and then a young comedian like Steve Martin would come through town and do one night at some of these music, folk music houses.
Right. Okay. Yeah. He talked about that in Born Standing Up, doing a lot of very, coffee houses and a lot of that stuff.
Right. Mm-hmm. And there was one in Berkeley called, I forget what it was called, but there just wasn't comedy clubs around the country. It wasn't a thing to go out. And I will tell you the reason I think that it's so big now is because the studios have abdicated a night of comedy during that time, and even up until not long ago, till the woke wall hit wave, you know, drowned everybody. The studios would put out sometimes three comedies a weekend. So people would go out and watch a great comedy at the movie theater. And when you stopped, when you can't do that, it became just so comfortable to go to a club or a theater and watch a comedian.
Well, yeah, it almost became for a little while like going to a speakeasy. You weren't allowed to actually see real comedy. If you're going to the movies too, you know it's going to suck.
Yep.
Because most of the ones that have come out in the last few years, let's be honest, not great. I'm not saying there aren't exceptions, but everybody's...
Oh, there are no exceptions.
Yeah, thank you.
There's no comedies anymore. No, like, when was the last time there was a good comedy in the theater?
No, they don't even make
them. They don't
exist. And my point was, when they were making comedies, they were R-rated, or they were just goofy, stupid comedy.
Yes.
I feel like people are scared to make comedies now.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's exactly what it is. The corporations don't want to get sued, or they don't want to, you know,
offend a bunch of people or start a big,
Well, they don't want a bunch of trans Jews in their parking lot protesting people that used to be Christians a week ago. Now they're Jews.
I drive a trans Jew.
You drive a trans Jew?
Yes.
I heard those are great trucks.
Versatile.
Yeah. Wonderful.
Yeah. They don't work on Friday nights.
No, they do not.
No.
It's the Sabbath.
They're very nice, though.
I love Dave, like, kind of subtly explaining my jokes every now and then. For you truckers out there, he just made a Jew joke.
In case you want to know.
Sabbath is Friday night when the Jews don't work.
And they're like, I see. Is that why? Oh, that's why I like. Why I like Fridays.
Yeah.
So I didn't know that.
There's less Jews on the highway. Is that what it is?
That explains why it's less complaining at the restaurant.
I burned down my own house.
That's what it is.
So when you made Blank Man, this is a question I always had. Was that supposed to be Handyman, and then they kind of...
That's exactly what it is.
I wanted to ask...
How did that go down?
I loved Handyman.
I did too, boy. But he didn't have the rights to that.
Okay.
And, I had made this movie called Indian Summer. Well, first of all...
Kevin Pollak. Yes. And I watched it with my dad when I was a kid.
Yeah,
I love that movie.
Yeah, thank you. It was set at my old summer camp.
Was it really?
Yeah, a bunch of kids from Detroit used to go up there and canoe tripping camp, and it was just fun. But I had this movie out. It was a Disney Touchstone film, and I knew Damon from the clubs when we were starting.
So good.
I knew him and his brother, and he's just a great guy. And that movie did well. It opened really well.
I saw it in the theater the day it came out.
No, I'm talking about Indian Summer.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And that Blank Man bombed.
I know Blank Man bombed, but I saw it.
Such a good movie, though.
But no, it had a great life afterwards. Yeah. But so anyway, I come out of the theater the night, it opened. You go see it. I want to see it with a full house. And Damon's there. And he goes, hey, man, I just came out at Indian Summer. I'm thinking, what are you doing at Indian Summer? He goes, I came to see you. see your movie, man. I really loved it. I wanted to ask you if you would direct my movie, you know? And it's like a Batman spoof and da-da-da. And I was like, yes.
I love that's how he puts it.
It's Batman.
It's like Batman, but I'm, you know, Downsy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was a spoof. It was a spoof.
They're the, you know? They're like the kings of spoofs at that time.
They are the best.
And I just said yes because I wanted to work with them.
Of course.
Because my best friend growing up, one of them who I went to that camp with and who's in Indian Summer is Sam Raimi.
Right.
You know?
Who I love.
I'm sorry, what?
I'm sorry, his Evil Dead shirt?
Yeah, that's my buddy. He's this day. You know, we grew up together and we went to camp together.
I'm such a huge fan of Sam Raimi.
He's in that movie Indian Summer. He played a guy we knew growing up.
So yeah.
And so
both of you guys are just phenomenal. And I'm sorry, I just got hard.
Go on. For real, me too.
But anyway,
I'm awake.
So anyway,
so did she.
Sam had just done this really cool movie called The Dark Knight. No, not The Dark Knight.
Oh, you mean Army of Darkness?
No.
Dark Man.
No, with Liam Neeson.
Dark Man.
Why am I not listening to you? You know.
It was Dark
Man. Which I love.
Which is an awesome movie.
Too.
Loved it. And we were comic book freaks.
Yeah.
We were comic book freaks. That's why in Indian Summer, they paint on the walls all the Spider-Man and everything.
Yeah.
You know, so I said, I want to do it. And my agent and my manager and everyone, no, you're not doing that. You're not doing a Damon Wayans movie and that you're directing. And
so you fired him, right?
I
got rid of him.
I basically did, you know, but I was like, they said, if this movie bombs, you're not going to work for a long time. And I didn't understand that. I had come out of stand-up comedy. I had made my own little movies, Crossing the Bridge, which is about guys growing up in
going
Detroit.
Over to Canada.
Yeah.
I love that movie.
And made a little...
And lived it.
Yeah. It was a very autographic... And Indian Summer was an biographical movie. And I saw this as just helping a friend produce his album.
Yeah.
That's what I thought it was. I was just, you know... But this was a big studio movie, and they said, when it bombs, if it bombs, you'll take the heat, you'll go to jail... And Damon will go on, because Damon was a big movie star at the time.
Yeah, he was doing, that was the last Mo Money.
Yeah.
And then also, but I mean, you're coming off of a hot thing. He was still on In Living Color, which was huge.
It didn't work that way. I had one hot kind of, personal movie.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I didn't have a big studio movie. And this thing was a really expensive movie for that kind of thing.
Right.
And it came out, it tested through the roof. They thought they had a big hit, and it bombed. It bombed.
Why do you think that was? Because it did have a second life.
Black people? Come on, let's not kid each other.
Damon Wayans, though.
No one's ever been entertained by them.
Even Damon Wayans said, I don't like black people. Why should I go to this?
But it had such a second life, you know, on the home movie market.
It was a great movie. Yeah. It was a great fun. And I won't stand this too long, but it was, so many people tried to talk me out of making that movie.
Glad they didn't.
So many people tried to tell me, said, you're going to be like Barry Levinson. You're going to be this and that, you know, Damon Wayne. And I said, they all called me and said, he's so hard to work with. People don't like working with him. He fights with everybody. And Damon and I, we did not have one coarse word for a year. We made every day of that movie. We just got along so well.
Comics.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's exactly why we were
on the same page.
We were on the same page, and David Alan Grier, and we laughed, and they made fun of me, and I made fun of them, and we made a movie that the audiences loved, but they couldn't sell it. They didn't know how to sell it. And the truth is, they wanted to see Handyman. They didn't want to see Damon being all effeminate. But the truth is, when they saw it on television over the years, they adored it. Kids go, and to this day, kids go trick or treating.
I grew up with that movie.
Yeah.
It's a great movie.
Right. Like, we went out.
Well, a quarter of you must have loved it.
That's the only reason I watched it.
We went out the night it came out, because everything that I was kind of raised on was largely the Wayans brothers. I mean, Don't Be a Menace. I went out the second it came out, all that stuff, because I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker was one of the first parodies I saw with Airplane.
Great.
And yeah, I went out and saw that the day it came out. I loved it because I knew it was Handyman. And I knew even then when I was young, I'm like, I'm sure they just couldn't do that, you know? But it's so strange when something bombs when you watch it when you're young because you don't care.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
The movie's everything to you and you love it. And that's all I knew. And I met David Alan Greer at the Comedy Castle. And it was the first time his mom had seen him do stand-up because he had started in theater.
Right.
So he's like, yeah, my mom's out there. And it's the first time she's seeing me. And I was like, what? Like, I couldn't even wrap my head around that. But because of like Blank Man and meeting him or meeting you, it was just incredible to me that he was in Detroit and I got to watch him do stand up and like all these people, like all that stuff means the world to me. So even if something bombs, I think it's just incredible that you made something that connects with so many people.
Yeah. Oh, it's been amazing. I'll tell you a great David Alan Greer story. Damon and I go to New York. We're in New York on something else, and David's doing a Mammoth play.
So he's saying fuck as much as possible. I love Mammoth.
Mammoth's awesome. Yeah,
it's an amazing play, and I'm blanking on the name. It's called Race.
Okay.
And it's amazing.
Oh, this was just a few years ago.
Yeah. This was years after we did Blank Man.
Yeah.
But we go with Damon's father and his sister Kim to dinner, and then we go see the play for David because we want to see David in this play, and it's amazing, but it's so dirty. And about 35, 40 minutes into the movie, Mr. Waynes gets up and he goes out and he doesn't come back. So at intermission, I go, what happened to your dad? He goes, too many swear words. he said, really? He left because there was too many swear words? I thought he was kidding when he said earlier, if there's swear words, I'm not going to be able to deal with it at dinner, you know? So we go backstage and David is so excited that Mr. Waynes is there to see him. You know, just someone's, another generation, you know?
Right, yeah.
Where's your dad? He walked out. He walked out. You know, it's like, it took all the wind out of his sails. And then David Mamet comes in. He goes, what are you? Damon's father walked out. He walked out. Why did he walk out? Didn't like it. I just like,
wow.
Hey, dig a little deeper.
Yeah.
You know.
I think it's so funny though, because his dad's also like, by the way, if any consolation, I've never seen a thing my kids have
yeah,
either.
Right.
Like, they've made the dirtiest films. Like, I'm going to get...
He doesn't. He didn't.
I know. It's the thing is, he probably has a lot of times watching his own kids just doing what they do.
He passed just a few years ago.
No, rest in peace, but
he was a very religious guy.
Yeah.
Great guy, you know.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, he raised an army of talent. Yeah. And I can't think of one.
Hardworking.
Almost every single
one of them.
And good people.
Yeah.
Good people.
Yeah, every one of them that I've met, I've liked.
Except for a couple of them. A couple of them are real shitheads.
Yeah, I think, you know, and I'm sure, yeah, there's one that they don't even talk about.
Yeah, every family has
those. Yeah, there's like Key Lime Waynes. No one's
like, yeah, we can talk about him.
Yeah, don't bring him up. Yeah. Anything.
One time we were talking about that, and Damon said, isn't it weird, though, to me, he goes, you're that guy in this family, your family?
Yeah.
He goes, doesn't it bother you?
The one I wanted to ask you about, too, it's a heavy movie, especially to be directed by a comic, you know, was Rain Over Me.
Yeah.
With, if you haven't seen it, it's Adam Sandler and Don Cheadle. And it's one of the Adam Sandler roles that I always love seeing him in because he just reminds everybody of what an absolutely amazing actor that he is.
Yeah.
And
he's a really good actor.
He's
huh?
so good. I mean, Punch Drunk Love.
Uncut Gems.
Comedians, it seems like, really have that range where they can like really wow you with like a dramatic performance.
I think it's partially like because you don't expect it, but then...
Hey, what did she do to lose this seat? That's what I want to know.
Oh.
they put me back here.
Yeah, I was going to say, man.
She's a woman.
I was going to ask that.
Comes with the...
There's
company.
An oven range right here, like a stove top.
Oh, if you wanted a sandwich, I can get you one.
It's part of the Blaze deal.
Yeah,
the contract.
But you know, comics are really good actors. You know, Robert Klein was in that, and he's I've worked with a lot of comics as actors, and they're good.
Yeah.
They're good, especially if you treat them good.
Well, they seem to not have a lot of the, and I know Robin Williams was Juilliard, but they seem to not have a lot of that, like, I'm always in character. I'm always, you know, they don't take it as seriously as everyone else, but they also have that insecurity of a comic where they don't want to fail.
Yeah.
So they seem to put it all of them into it.
There's also, and like, from the audience, there's a lot of expectations that, oh, you're just the funny guy. You're the funny guy that can tell jokes and make me laugh. That's all you can do.
Yeah.
And to see so many comedians come out and do serious roles and kill it is, you know, it's just like a testament to they're talented in one spot and they can be talented in
just
a
the
lot
depth.
Of other
stuff. Yeah.
Well, Uncut Gems is the most anxiety
filled,
isn't it?
Panic inducing film.
I love it.
I do too.
Love
it. It's a roller coaster.
It feels
though.
Like you're like gambling running. While you're watching it.
It does. Yeah.
Like, I just running on a treadmill this whole time.
I have to say, it's funny you brought this up.
Yeah.
Because the Biden presidency reminds me of Uncut Gems.
I agree.
It's like it's like every time you think he's not going to go further out in the ice.
He does. Every time?
Every time you think, okay, he won't do it this time.
Well, did you see what he just did?
No.
Okay. What did he just do?
I have to find, it's fantastic. This is great that you brought that up because I do have to share. Okay. He suggested that, you know, his uncle was at war where he couldn't quite remember.
I saw that. Isn't that great?
Yeah. He said that they never found his uncle whose plane went down, who was a pilot. Turns out he wasn't a pilot. He said he was a pilot in the Air Force before the Air Force, which also makes no sense.
It's unbelievable.
And they never found him because he crashed in New Guinea and a bunch of cannibals ate him, which there's no proof of.
I love this.
Isn't that a Rockefeller story?
This is a guy who will just make up his life.
Just makes them up.
As it goes on. And he thinks no one forgets. You know, every time in Scranton, my family and I would go over to the Jews' house and have bagels. And we'd go to the Blacks to have pizzas. And then every now and then, the cannibals would come over and they'd put us in a big bowl of boiling water. And it's just like, wait a minute. How many lives did you have? There's only...
And it all started too with Cracker Jack.
Corn Pop.
Corn Pop.
We actually have the video too. If you guys would like to see it. Yeah.
You have to, I love it. I love it just for the audience. They have to see this.
Please.
Outstanding.
I'm going to call him Uncle Bozy. He was shot down. He was an Army Air Corps before there was an Air Force. He flew single engine planes, reconnaissance flights over New Guinea. He had volunteered because someone couldn't make it. He got shot down in an area where there were a lot of cannibals in New Guinea at the time. They never recovered his body, but the government went back when I went down there and they checked and found some parts of the plane and the like.
So, I wouldn't suggest voting for Biden, but I'll tell you who you should vote for because he's on the phone right now. Please welcome to the program, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. How are you today, sir?
Very good. Is that Dave?
This is me. It's Dave Lando, and of course, you're on with your buddy Mike Binder.
Yeah.
Hello.
Oh, hey, guys. Oh.
And of course, we have
Quarter Black Garrett. How are you doing?
He's a quarter black, and of
That's
course,
true.
We have Angela. And I just want to say, sir, I'm a very big fan, and I'm really looking forward to working with you Sunday night in Royal Oak at the Royal Oak Music Theater.
Yeah, that's in Detroit, and Dave, I hear you're going to do the other show that we have in Nashville.
Yeah, I'm going to be at the Ryman Theater with you, which I'm looking forward to as well.
And Dave is also really good friends with Jim Brewer, who's on the show in Nashville, and a bunch of the other comics, Rob and Rob Schneider, and Bobby, you don't know, but Dave is really one of my favorite comedians right now. I just love what he's doing, and
thank you.
And he's also
Dave. I'm really looking forward to hearing you and to meeting you in person, and I'm really grateful for you doing this.
I think. Go on. I'm sorry, sir.
No, no. Go ahead.
I've just never talked to a Kennedy. This is a first for me. I have to be honest. I recovering addict, went to high school for 5 years. It's the first time I've been this close to somebody like this. Not really allowed near presidential candidates.
Yeah. As a rule.
Well, I'm glad you're talking to me and not one of my siblings because they're all in Pennsylvania today endorsing President Biden.
You know, I wasn't going to bring that up, but boy, that sucks, right? I don't know how else to word that. I was like, what the hell is this?
How's Thanksgiving?
Yeah, well, I don't know what next Thanksgiving is going to look like. But you know, we got a big family, so I got a lot of notes.
That's good.
They have support from other members who actually do support me. I think there's 105 Kennedys. They had five of them there today. But, you know, they're my siblings, so it's, you know, I'm not like, worried about it. My family differs with me on a lot of issues. Like, every family in America has differences, and, you know, I have five members of my family who are working for the Biden administration, and I've known President Biden for 40 years. A lot of my family members have very close relationships with him. He has a bust of my father behind him in the Oval Office, and, you know, so I understand there and being dismayed at my decision to run. Mike knows this. We come from a family that we were schooled to argue with each other, to debate each other. My father orchestrated and presided over debates among the kids, just like his father did, Joseph Kennedy, with his nine children. And we were taught to debate energetically and passionately, but not to hate each other. And I feel like it's a good, I wish our country could have that, where we could differ on issues. I love my family. Mike knows that.
Can I also say something? Cause I know his siblings and I know Bobby loves them. And one of the things that when Bobby started running for president, my first thing was, I know Bobby's a uniter, and I've never heard Bobby badmouth anybody, even people he totally disagrees with. He's not a bad mouther. It's just not his way. And I know that his family too, when Bobby wins and becomes president, which is going to happen, his family is going to totally support him, you know, and that's just the fact of the matter. This is just political differences, but these are not people that are saying, hey, he's a bad guy. Yeah. You know, this is not these type of politicians. These are just differences. And they're going to end up supporting Bobby in a big way.
Well, and that's what I've noticed.
They'll have to get across the moat that I'm going to dig around the White House. So.
What'd you say?
He's going to dig a moat.
Yes, yes.
Well, that's what I've noticed about you, though. You're very passionate and honest with your beliefs. And to be frank, it would just be nice to have somebody in office who is being honest. Yeah. And you're not angry and you're not being vile. You're just being passionate, which is something
he's
you just
honest
don't
and
see.
He's, but he's never, he's not a bad mouther, or he doesn't come from a churlish place. I love his honesty on all these issues. And you know what? Listen, by the way, I'm married into a big Irish family. Okay. And I've got a bunch of brothers. And if any one of mine got anywhere near the Oval Office, I'd be out there with a fire hose. So
they'd be passed out drunk on the lawn.
Yeah, exactly. but I look it.
That's how my family is too. Irish, Italian.
I am so excited about Bobby being the president.
I just think it's relieving to see somebody talk honestly and openly. And I really, really, well, you have my vote, that's for sure.
Well, thanks, Dave. You know, it's I've seen this big change in the trust in our government. When I was a kid, 80% of Americans, when my uncle was president, said that they trusted the United States of America and did not believe the government would ever lie to us. And actually, the first time that the government really got caught lying to the American public in a big way was in 1959, right before my uncle's election, when Gary Francis Powers, who was a U-2 pilot, got shot down over Russia. And the U-2s flew so high that they were
cannibals.
Invisible.
No, I'm sorry. I had to.
Can you guys hear me?
Yes, I'm sorry. Yep.
Yeah, and he was supposed to commit suicide. He had a cyanide shot on him, and they were instructed it was a CIA program, the U2 program that was photographing. It was spying on Russia. Nobody knew about it. It was top secret, and he was supposed to kill himself. So Alan Dulles, who was the head of the CIA, went to Eisenhower when the Russians said, hey, we just shot down your U-2 plane and you were spying on us. And it was an international incident. And Dulles told Eisenhower to deny it. He said, the pilot is dead. Mm-hmm. They're never going to be able to prove it. So Eisenhower went out and denied it. He said there was no such program. And then the Russians had held Gary Francis Powers back, and they produced him. And the whole cat was out of the bag. And Americans for the first time went, holy cow, our government was lying, not just to the world, but also to us.
Yeah.
But even, you know, my uncle then became president, and people still generally believe the United States. In 1973, the Pentagon Papers were released, and that was this very, very detailed history of how hundreds of government officials had systematically lied to the American public about the Vietnam War. And that's when Americans really stopped believing their government. And then the Warren Commission report, when my uncle was killed in the 63,
yeah.
1964, you know, half of Americans at that point, about 75% today, just believed that the Warren Commission was a pack of lies.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really a big fork in the road for our country. And today, most Americans just believe our government is lying to us all the time. And if you don't believe that, you're not paying attention, because it is. And the worst part about it during COVID is, at least we used to have the American press who was calling the government on its lies. You know, they'd go along with them, like with the Iraq War and the weapons of mass destruction. They'd go along with it for a while, but then they'd say, you know, the New York Times published an apology for, you know, drumming up the war in Iraq and for believing, Bush-Cheney propaganda and getting us into the war. So they publicly apologized for it. But now they're just openly lying. They're openly repeating government lies, and there is no accountability. They'll never admit it. They'll never admit what they did during COVID. And, it's hard to see where this is going to end unless we really elect dramatically different leadership who's calling them on it.
Well, absolutely.
And the only way that you can heal this divide between Americans, it's all amplified because nobody believes the government anymore. Yeah. So there's so many different versions of truth out there. And people gravitate to their own versions. And there's nothing bringing us back to the center.
I agree. And I think there's so many different versions of government we see because there's so many different officials. And I think, like you said, there's no integrity in the press for us to believe any of that. And I think the real problem is, let's say I know that, you know, there's only a few companies that do own all of the press, but people that write it, there's so many articles, there's so much information. You're not even making the money that you once did for writing out these lies. People are putting out all this information for very little money, for clicks, for slight amounts of fame. It's almost meaningless what people are putting out as misinformation to make a profit off of now. Mm-hmm. So just as somebody, I've talked about it on the show, my dad went to Vietnam. He died of Agent Orange when I was a teenager, and of brain cancer. The government took no responsibility for it. They gave him nothing, and I watched him go bankrupt. So I've seen what they do to their own soldiers. That led to my mom's own mental illness and eventually her suicide. And I've seen them not care about that either. So my distrust of the government happened when I was a young man, seeing the government absolutely not care about my father and my family after forcing him into a war that he didn't want to be a part of, even though he was a medic, he was a hero. And you see that happen. Like, what, for somebody like me, how could I ever learn to trust the government again? Because I haven't had trust for them since I was, I don't know, five?
Wow, what a story. And, you know, the Agent Orange story, the woman who CDC collaborated with the VA and the Pentagon because they didn't want to pay this tsunami of medical care
That's
caused.
Right.
They didn't want to admit that they were war related, and you know they were classifying them as PTSD or just, you know, a lot of people just get cancers. Mm-hmm. So, and the woman that they put in charge of that CDC was a woman named Colleen Boyle. And she was in charge of orchestrating the entire denial program at Agent Orange. And she got exposed. My uncle, Senator Ted Kennedy, had hearings in 1975 and exposed the whole fraud. And Colleen Boyle was embroiled in these scandals. And, you know, she lost her. She was transferred by CDC to get her out of the limelight. But guess where she ended up? She ended up as head of the Immunization Safety Office, which is the vaccine program.
Oh, perfect.
And she was put in charge of managing the, the autism cover-up. And that's where she is today. She's the same woman.
And I am angry about hearing that just now, but I'm not even the least bit surprised. Because if you told me it was somebody who was competent and actually cared about people, that would shock me. But the fact that it's somebody who isn't, you're like, no, that's about right. That's par for the course.
That's
why I think that we do need somebody like you to restore faith in our government and in our leadership, because we need actual leaders. We don't need people just shaking each other's hands and trying to figure out how to wrestle money away from Americans. I mean, we really are feeling it, and I see it every day with people. After the pandemic and what I saw do to so many of my friends, so many people lose their businesses, come close to losing their businesses, losing their families, the way that it destroyed America. And my mom herself was an RN, and it's not like that makes me, you know, some sort of medical expert in any way whatsoever. But the way they were rushing the vaccine, things were going on, it just seemed completely incorrect to me. So my own personal opinion was, I'm going to wait on this, even though I had all the other ones. And the amount of friends I lost, the arguments I had, but like I just said, of what had happened to me and what I went through in my life, I had my own, what I felt very vindicated personal opinions to be skeptical of what they were doing. And now when you tell me to stay at home for 24 hours because I have something that shut down an economy for 2 years, I feel that, I don't know, I was right.
Yep. Well, Dave, it's really good to hear you, and I can't wait to meet you when I'm in Detroit. I got to go make a speech right now. I'm in Palos Verdes, and Mike, thanks for doing this.
Yes.
Dave, I really, really can't wait to meet you.
Likewise.
And just to repeat.
Hey, what about Quarter Black? Wouldn't you like to meet him one day, Bobby?
You don't want to.
Yeah, is he there?
Not good.
He wants to meet three quarters of them.
Yeah.
So, all right, listen, Bobby, thanks and sorry about all the problems. These guys, they spent their money on a Democratic guest.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Come along, pal.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sorry that got real for a second.
Oh, that did. Yeah. It did.
Oh, it was great.
I wanted to talk to a real person who I felt did something about that, and yep. I wanted to just say to him, thank you.
Yeah.
Honestly. Oh, I want you to talk to him more about it in person. Because,
I do, too.
Because he's an expert on all that.
And
he loves to hear about that kind of story.
And I've heard his family may have been screwed by the government a time or two.
Maybe.
I don't remember, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, listen, you know, every time someone says to me, you know, trust the science or trust the government, I go, the government killed the president, okay? I don't trust them for anything.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah. Well, and
killed the president when the president was doing wasn't doing what they wanted him to do.
He's totally right. When that trust between the American public and the government was broken, it just got worse and worse and worse and worse. And we're at a point where it's just completely, we don't believe a single word that they will ever say. If aliens came down and landed on the front lawn of the White House, we'd be like, fake.
I'm pretty sure they did.
Well, not only that,
that was Independence Day.
They're all leading out, trying to get this guy reelected,
yeah.
Who just keeps making up stories about, yeah, well, my uncle was eaten by cannibals, and my aunt crawled up some monster's butt and died.
That's the thing, is like the lies don't get like more sensible. They've gotten more ridiculous and ridiculous out.
Yeah. And I talk to my Democratic friends and I go, aren't you like scared?
Like at all?
It's funny, the ones that I've talked to are, and because Detroit was so largely Democratic and obviously is and has been for a long time, which is funny because, you know, we're the ones that you still can't find Hoffa. But like, the more you think about it and the more people I talk to, they're like, oh, no, I'm not for any of this. I can't. I think a lot of people are so without a home now when it comes to politics, and because there's just so many hands in the pockets of Americans, because I don't look at it any other way. It's like we're printing money. We're taxing you. We're doing all these things. None of it adds up anymore to It's like, why are we doing this? You make constant mistakes and then you're like, we'll bail out banks. Well, should they give out loans? Yeah, but we're going to do it at a 12% interest rate for your house. I'm sorry, what?
Yeah.
Like, how do you fucking sleep at night, you monsters?
like on piles and piles of cash.
Yeah, they're like, cash. I will say, understand?
And I will say, and I will tell you this, not in a, I'm not a politician and I'm not.
Oh, I know. I like
this is,
you.
This is the type of stuff that really is concerning to him. And this is why he wanted to run. And he called me. I was in Boston doing a comedy club. And he goes, I got to talk to you. I'm calling a few of my friends. I think I'm going to run for president. And he hadn't been talking about it at all. I'd never heard him talk about any. He goes, but I can't do this anymore. I can't watch this country go so bad. And he's not a power-hungry guy. And that family is not power-hungry. Service satiates them. They've been raised to be of service. I know the family really well, and they're not bad people, even the ones going against him. His brother Max is really one of my best friends, you know? Yeah. And Max is all up Biden's butt, you know? but that's just, he's going to end up being Bobby's real supporter. Mm-hmm.
Well, it takes such balls, because it's like having people in your family and like a bunch of them died falling out of trees and they're like, I think I'm going to rent a cherry picker. And you're like, you might want to hang on. Wait, what? Because it just shows that that's the actual passion that's coming out of somebody. They believe in something so much in their life. That's a level of fearlessness that we need.
Yeah.
That's taking a step forward that I don't think people can even wrap their head. In fact, they can't wrap their heads around it, because I don't think anybody else has ever had the political background that he has.
But they're not power hungry. They're not like, it's not about them. It's about helping people.
Those are the people that you want running, that see the problems that are going on with the country and say, how can I help? Not what can I get out of this?
Yeah. How can I gain?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I truly believe that Joe Biden is just he's a cannibal.
I do too.
He's an African
too.
Cannibal.
Yeah. He is.
He's a cannibal.
He just goes, I hate my uncle. Yeah. As a pilot. And
I ate my uncle. Next month. I called him Corn Pop, and then I just ate him.
Took a length of chain, and I was like, put down Ashley's diary. That's not real. And then,
don't read it.
He was made of corn.
That's fake news.
So I ate him.
You're going nibbled on it.
I'll see you in jail. If you put that
down. Yeah, it's like, I get your one kid, who's done more coke than half of Columbia, and then meanwhile you're like, quick, hurry, put that guy in jail. He's got her book.
He goes, you know, Hunter, man, Jack, Hunter's done a lot of coke, but it's made him a great artist.
That's like that's sure. The sad part, sure. Hasn't?
All right.
It's like, then you see his drawings. It's something that if your kid who was 8 brought home, you'd be like, oh, that's great. And the second he turned around, you just throw it in the trash. Yeah,
yeah. It's like every guy that tries acid for the first time, their paintings.
Yeah.
You're like, whoa, I'm seeing a whole other freaking spectrum of the world, man.
You're not sure what to tell him first. Just quit doing acid or painting.
Yeah. Or both.
Yeah, you're like, just
quit painting. Yeah, at least it doesn't hurt.
Yeah, you're like,
us,
definitely don't. Know. Yeah. Yeah, you're like, do your acid.
Yeah, you can do that over there.
Just don't ever show me what you make on it. Here's an idea. Next time, use a knife and whittle something. Yeah, it's the worst. And you see it sell, too.
Oh, well, for a lot.
Oh, absolutely.
I think it's a scam.
It sells in the art community, but it doesn't sell for a lot in the art community. Like, it does sell for a lot of money to me and you.
Even they will be like, no?
Yeah, but even in the art community, they're kind of like, wow. I'll give you, I guess, $300,000. But, like, if it was anybody else's son, it would be like $30 million.
No, people are looking at it going, boy, that sucks, but I could end up with an ambassadorship.
Yeah. It's the name. You're buying the name.
Well, it's the same as anybody. It's like Andy Warhol. Like, look, I get it. It's like, it's a soup can. And you're like, that's worth $30 billion dollars. I mean, clearly this man's on drugs and just blew a guy. It's got to be worth that.
I don't know, Dave. I think we just went off the rails when you compared Hunter Biden to Andy Warhol.
Oh, no, I meant very different. Oh, no.
You know, it's all, sometimes I look at that Hunter Biden shit and I think, Andy Warhol, what was he thinking?
I meant the contrast of good and bad.
Bad way.
I'm kidding. What the hell was that Andy Warhol's shit all about?
Maybe Picasso was just some famous dude's
grandson. That's what it was. And this Monet,
what is that?
It's just a bunch of flowers and stuff. Who can't do that?
Yeah, Mona Lisa. It's like, yeah, why isn't she smiling? It's like, because of the crackhead who's banging his niece is painting the picture.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was.
It's like, smile. She's like, I can't after what he did to me.
Well, this got dark. Art is just supposed to be pictures of ships and horses.
Yeah, well, it's always like art's in the eye of the beholder, but whatever Hunter made, it's like, you're just high. Stop it. It's not art.
Hey, boy, can I just say something?
Yes, please.
About the Biden kids. Have you ever seen kids that wanted to get caught so bad in their lives?
It's such a cry for help for their dad.
It's just like everyone in that family just wants to they're throwing flags out the window. You know, we're all crooked and getting raped. Quick, call somebody.
All of us.
He's recording it on laptops.
And leaving them.
He's going to like Geek Squad and being like, hi, I'm not Hunter Biden. Please don't look at what's on this and tell daddy I need a hug.
Fix that.
She's writing her darkest secrets in a diary and leaving it at the 7-Eleven.
They're just like leaving breadcrumbs like, guys, come
please,
on.
Anyone,
just please, somebody follow these.
Hunter is leaving coke in such open places that they're able to do a news story about how it was out at the White House.
They're like, oh, we can't figure out who it is.
Yeah, we don't know who it belongs to.
We have the best detectives available.
Yes. I'm telling you, those are kids that hate him.
Yes.
They just want him. They want Trump elected so bad.
I guarantee you Hunter just stood in front of his house for the first 10 years of life holding a baseball glove and waiting.
Fishing pole.
That's so sad.
That's
all it was. Standing out in that racial angle.
We do have to jump out. I got to catch an early flight to Tacoma, obviously. Okay. If you're not going to be there, I'm going to be at the Tacoma Comedy Club. But then I'm going to be catching a flight to... Where are we going to be?
You're going to be at the Royal Oak Theater in Detroit. Outside of Detroit.
Hey, that's the right poster.
That's right.
Right with who we got? We got Rob Schneider and we got Dave Landau.
We got my girl Heather J, who I love.
Heather J's fantastic.
Isn't she great?
Trey Roberts. Yeah. He's great. Trey Robinson and Erica Rhodes.
Erica Rhodes is fantastic.
The Beatles are going to be there.
The Beatles. We're going to have a guy who impersonates Ringo really well.
Yeah.
It's going to be
pretty
good.
It's going to be a really good show. And also we're going to be at the Ryman Auditorium.
That's right.
In Nashville, May 15th.
There you go. So go out to that show as well. And to the guy online who said that I'd never play the Ryman again, who was all twatty, May 15th, buddy.
Yeah. See you there.
Good night.
Did someone really say that?
Yeah.